Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we are immersing ourselves in a text that's, well, it's less a traditional philosophy book and more a series of meticulously crafted grenades.
That's a great way to put it.
We're talking about Theodore Adorno's 1951 masterpiece, Minima Moralia, Reflections from Damaged Life.
And it's arguably the central work of, you know, the second generation of critical theory. But what gives it this unique, unsettling power is the context.
Context, right.
Adorno wrote the bulk of this, these 153 interconnected observations, mostly during his exile in the U.S. between 1924 and 1946.
So he's safe in Los Angeles, but he's looking back.
Exactly. He's reflecting on the total historical collapse in Europe, the rise of fascism, the mechanized horror of the war, and he's analyzing what that collapse meant for the modern individual who survived, or I guess pretended to survive.
That subtitle, Reflections from Damaged Life. That's really the key, isn't it?
It's everything.
Adorno believed that after the Holocaust and the rise of what he called the culture industry, the traditional goal of philosophy, this idea of building a sweeping, totalizing system of truth.
It was impossible.
Not just impossible, but maybe even dishonest. The truth itself had become fractured.
Precisely. And so the aphoristic form, the fragmented style, that's a philosophical choice in itself. It's a necessary fragmentation.
I see.
Our sources confirm the book moves logically, almost surgically. It starts with the narrowest, most immediate world Adorno's own existence as an intellectual exile in the U.S. That's part one.
Okay.
Then it expands out to a broader social and anthropological scope in parts two and three. It's like a camera pulling focus.
Okay, let's unpack this. So our mission is to follow that trajectory. We're going to distill the key dense concepts that reveal how modern society, under the pressure of late capitalism, systematically damages human experience.
From our most intimate thoughts, too.
To our social interactions.
Yeah.
Everything. We'll begin where Adorno begins, in the damaged sphere of private life.
Mm.
So we're starting with aphorism one for Marcel Proust, which immediately gets into the intellectual's dilemma.
Right.
Adorno himself, he came from a pretty well-to-do background, and he sees the intellectual who chooses knowledge over commerce as a kind of a deserter from the bourgeoisie.
Yes, and he asks, what is the fate of this deserter? And the answer is, it's a cruel trap.
How so?
The intellectual who chose the life of the mind, often out of, as he says, repugnance for the ignominy of earning money, they quickly find that the intellectual world itself,
scholarship, art, philosophy,
all of it has been assimilated. It's become practical, a specialized business with strict division of labor.
So the very thing you were trying to escape from.
It's waiting for you in your supposed refuge.
And the moment you try to maintain that purity of thought, or the moment you actually take pleasure in the work itself,
the system hits back.
It labels you.
It does. Adorno's insight here is brutal. He says anyone who avoids this division of labor, anyone who tries to maintain some intellectual independence, is instantly labeled a dilettante.
A dilettante, right. An amateur. Someone not to be taken seriously.
Exactly. The intellectual's work has to conform to market metrics, to specialization and utility. Adorno calls it sanctioning the operations imposed by society.
So if you're a professor, you have to be a specialist in one tiny, narrow field.
And if you're an artist, you'd better produce commercially viable content.
And God forbid you enjoy wide-ranging inquiry. You're punished for not specializing.
Absolutely. The class the intellectual defected from, as he says, takes its revenge by structuring the very refuge the intellectual sought. It's an enforced conformity.
It's a perfect system in a way.
It is. Those who need the money must specialize to live, and those who could, you know, afford independence are prevented from participating precisely because they refuse that specialization.
So intellectual life is either specialized servitude or exiled irrelevance.
That's it. A chilling frame around the concept of pleasure in work.
So if the intellectual sphere is compromised, what about the physical sphere? The home. Aphorism 2, grassy seat, shifts to the decay of the family.
Yes, and this is a really profound sociological observation. He's linking economic change directly to emotional pathology.
He talks about the sad, shadowy transformation of the relationship with parents.
He does. Historically, the bourgeois father represented authority, economic power, his awesomeness, Adorno calls it.
But in modern economic systems, that power often becomes impotent, right?
Right. And it turns the relationship into something cold and fragile. The father can no longer pass on a secure inheritance or a thriving business. He's just another employee, really.
And the younger generation's reaction, It isn't rebellion. That would at least imply some kind of agency.
No, it's not rebellion. He calls it a preemptive surrender.
Wow.
They are insufferably more grown up because they just renounce the conflict before it even starts. They see their parents' struggle as irrelevant, which makes their parents' emotional life insignificant.
They get a kind of grim, authoritarian power from that act of surrender.
They do. It's a very dark idea, this premature renunciation.
So what's actually lost when that traditional family structure dissolves? It's not like it was perfect.
No, it was deeply repressive. But Adorno argues what is lost is the paradoxical humanity that structure, maybe accidentally, fostered.
What do you mean?
The passing of the family liquidates what he calls the utopia that once drew sustenance from motherly love. It was this residual space of non-instrumental value, unconditional care, possibility.
A space outside the market.
A space outside the market logic. And when that source of opposition, however flawed it was, is paralyzed, the rising collective order becomes purely oppressive. The violence done to the parents by the system is forgotten by the children who preemptively forgot the parents.
So what we're losing in the home isn't just safety, but the foundational emotional template for resisting the system's logic.
That is the key Adornian claim. Even in its repressive form, the family strengthened the individual subject. Its decay leaves the individual utterly exposed and weak against the machinery of society.
And that machinery, that market logic, is the subject of Aphorism 3, Fish and Water, the universalization of commerce.
Yes. Adorno notes that during the era of high concentration industry, the older sphere of circulation, you know, the world of traders, agents, middlemen, it's largely superseded by massive centralized production.
Okay.
Yet, and this is the paradox, private life itself becomes saturated with the form of commerce. People become agents and go-betweens even when there's no actual business to transact.
You see this everywhere today, the intense focus on networking, on personal branding.
Exactly. The original text details how people believe they can only appease the omnipresent executive power through empathy, assiduity, serviceability, arts, and dodges by tradesmen's qualities.
Everything is a transaction.
Every relationship is now seen as a connection, measured by its potential utility. Your own spontaneous impulses get censored by your own mind. Is this acceptable? Does this serve my network?
The system's irrationality.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that people are desperately acting like agents without any actual business.
It is perfectly mirrored in the parasitic psychology of the individual. They live their lives trying to divine the secret judgments of power.
That sounds exhausting.
It creates a state of perpetual anxiety, what Adorno calls scrupulous unscrupulousness.
Scrupulous unscrupulousness.
You're scrupulous in your performance of conformity, but you're unscrupulous in your ultimate goal of self-advancement. The line between being a friend and a professional contact just, it vanishes.
Which brings us to the core ethical breakdown in interaction. He explores this so deeply in Aphorisms 5 and 16. Aphorism 5, how nice of you, doctor, hits you with this shocking concept that nothing innocuous left.
It's a staggering realization, and you have to remember, it's driven by the trauma of fascism. Adorno is arguing that the totality of the system is so complete that every simple pleasure, every neutral declaration, every moment of ease...
And about them?
They directly serve their diametrical opposite. If you allow yourself a moment of pleasure, you imply pliancy towards the superior might of the existent.
So even enjoying a piece of music or a movie becomes compromised. Because it's a distraction from the ongoing horror.
Yes. The intellectual has to recognize that sharing the smallest step towards the dominant society's pleasures means moving one step towards the hardening of their pains.
So what's the solution?
This is where he reaches his famous and very demanding conclusion. The intellectual must practice inviolable isolation as the only true form of solidarity.
Wow.
All collaboration, all social mixing becomes a tacit acceptance of inhumanity.
But that stance is so often criticized, right? People call it elitist or impossibly cynical. How does he defend that absolute isolation?
He sees it not as a preference, but as an ethical necessity. In a world where shared experiences are manufactured by the culture industry, to participate is to endorse the system that produces the pleasures and the pain at the same time.
He mentions going to the cinema.
Yes, he says every cinema visit, despite all his vigilance, left him stupider and worse. The seemingly positive, egalitarian spirit of it all, it unfurls its full bestiality.
So making yourself seem like you're no better than anyone else is actually a form of violence.
It's functionally the same as condescension. The only true ethical space left is the refusal to play the game.
In Aphorism 16, on the Dialectic of Tact breaks down why even simple courtesy, or tact, fails in this environment.
Tact, historically, was this necessary saving accommodation in early industrial society. It was a way for alienated individuals to maintain distance and respect.
But Adorno says its time has passed.
Its historical hour has passed. Today, individual tact is mere lying because it pretends that the underlying power structure, the system of inequality and hierarchy, just doesn't exist.
So what is modern tact hiding? What's the lie?
It masks the covetous eagerness to place him and his chances. You're being polite, Adorno suggests, not to accommodate the person, but to figure out where they stand in the social grid.
What their utility is.
What their utility is and where they fit into your own advancement. Formal courtesy becomes a lie when it denies that structural violence.
Which makes the modern, casual, familiar style of interaction, what he calls the rib-digging camaraderie, even worse than cold formality.
Oh, absolutely. That forced closeness is an ultimate mockery of freedom. It collapses necessary distance, and it ushers in a naked brutality cloaked in false warmth.
Because there's no buffer.
There's no buffer. The direct statement, the full-in-the-face communication, he says, it already has the form and timbre of the command issued under fascism by the dumb to the silent.
Civility becomes impossible. The very form of interaction is already dominated by this competitive, brutalizing impulse.
It is exhausting, as you said. The social disease is so total that even our attempts to be decent reinforce the structure.
And this contamination moves from social interaction to, well, to material reality in aphorisms 18 and 19.
He shifts to the physical dwelling, the house. Aphorism 18, Refuge for the Homeless, makes this incredible claim that dwelling, in the proper sense, is now impossible.
And he's writing this as a man in physical exile, reflecting on the fate of European cities, so it's deeply personal.
Very. And he identifies two failed forms of dwelling.
What are they?
The first is the traditional old European home. That requires a betrayal of knowledge. It's paid for by the musty pact of family interests, by secrecy and bourgeois hypocrisy.
And the second?
The second is the modern, functional, expertly designed home. You know, the Bauhaus aesthetic, the clean slate. He says these are just living cases manufactured by experts for Philistines.
Living cases.
Mass-produced containers with no unique relationship to the person inside. They liquidate the nostalgia for independent existence.
And the most chilling detail here is his connection between modern technology and wartime destruction.
Yes. It's an incredible sentence. He suggests that the destruction of European cities by Allied bombers during the war merely executed what technology had already decided was the house's fate.
So the house was already functionally defunct?
Exactly. Technology, through mass production and functionalist design, had already rendered the concept obsolete. The bombers just enacted the final violent structural decision.
And technology's brutality isn't just aimed at buildings. It's aimed at us, physically, and aphorism 19, do not knock.
Adorno details how technology is making gestures precise and brutal, and with them men. He asks you to consider the physical interface of things around us.
He points to slammed car doors, sliding windows.
Handles that replace gentle latches. These designs, they expel hesitation, civility, and accommodation from our movements. They demand a rapid, abrupt, almost aggressive interaction.
We are subjected to the implacable demands of objects.
Correct. The implication is that the new human type fast, abrupt, lacking delicate civility is manufactured not just ideologically, but physically. Through constant exposure to objects that demand violent, hard-hitting, unresting jerkiness.
It's fascinating to translate that to today. You think about the aggressive efficiency of touchscreens, the abruptness of digital interfaces that demand immediate swiping or clicking.
They all enforce a reduction of human interaction to raw, conditioned reflex.
It's the withering of experience through technological efficiency.
The design of the environment trains the nervous system for violence.
So part one establishes that specialization compromises the mind, commerce compromises relationships, and functional technology compromises our very bodies and movements. So now we shift inward. How does this external system internalize itself in our collective consciousness?
This transition is crucial. We move from the physical brutalization of the individual by objects to the psychic brutalization of the individual by institutions.
Specifically, psychology and social norms.
Exactly. The damaged life in part one finds its ideological justification in part two.
We start with the pathology of psychology in aphorisms 39 and 42. So aphorism 39, ego is I. It addresses psychology's internal contradiction.
Psychology promised to elevate man, right? To make him the measure of all things. But to measure him, it had to dissect him, to analyze him into his constituent parts and faculties.
And that process of dissection.
Adorno argues it's a direct projection of the division of labor onto its pretended subjects.
So the discipline that promises self-knowledge actually reduces the self to something manipulable, like a resource to be optimized.
It reduces the subject to an object. It transfers to him the nullity of things. Even when you look at Freud, whom Adorno greatly respected, the self is often dismissed as a mere prejudice.
I see.
Now, Adorno agrees that the traditional ego is often an ideological hypostasization of the abstract centers of domination. But if you remove that ideological self, that internal structure,
what's left?
The residue is just easier to control and deploy as a human resource.
And aphorism 42, baby with the bathwater, shows how organized culture then weaponizes these psychological insights.
This is a devastating critique of mass culture. Genuine analytical insights, which, you know, required immense suffering and clinical dedication to achieve, are just ripped from their context.
And turned into mass-produced articles.
Right. Think of concepts like inferiority complex or mother fixation. They become these conventional labels you hear everywhere in media, popular articles, self-help books.
So instead of achieving true self-awareness or catharsis,
people merely fit their conflicts as an unavoidable component into the surface of standardized life. They lose the terror before the abyss of the self.
Because their profound suffering is reduced to a recognizable, manageable category. It's like a checklist item.
Adorno compares this to dealing with arthritis or sinus trouble. The depth of the conflict is just erased.
And catharsis is replaced by what he calls the satisfaction of being a specimen of the majority.
Yes. The individual finds this narcissistic satisfaction in their suffering by identifying with the collective. They proudly embrace their specimen status.
It's a way of feeling powerful.
It is. They transfer the power of the vast administered collective onto themselves. The self is liquidated, and that liquidation is celebrated as a kind of modern psychological maturity.
You're well adjusted because you accept your pathology as normal.
You're one of the crowd.
This theme of normalization brings us directly to the critique of normality itself in aphorism 46. To them shall no thoughts be turned. Adorno asserts that normality is the sickness proper to the time. That's a radically counterintuitive statement.
It really is. It challenges the core assumption of Western thought that health is good. Adorno argues that the regular guy, the one who appears adjusted and successful, he achieves his libidinal achievements, his material success and perceived happiness, only at the cost of the profoundest mutilation.
An internalized castration of his desires and critical insights.
The cost of being normal is psychic death.
That's a heavy thought.
It is. He says the underlying prevalent health is death. The person bursting with apparent vitality could easily be taken for a prepared corpse. Their movements, their efficient functioning in society.
They're just reflexes.
They resemble the reflex movements of beings whose hearts have stopped beating. It's an analogy for the mechanical, unthinking adherence to an inherently destructive, militarized, administered order. True life, true subjectivity, is repressed for the sake of adjustment.
So if normality is death, then Adorno argues fascism is simply the moment the corpse twitches violently.
Right. He connects this in aphorism 123, The Bad Comrade, by tracing the logic of domination back to the microcosm of childhood.
He finds the seeds of fascism in the memories of his schoolfellows.
He says fascism wasn't some sudden external force. It was the inevitable realization of the bourgeois dream of a brutal, unquestioning national community. The bad comrade, the boy who tormented others, the one who was passed over but sought revenge. He was the advance guard.
It anchors the political nightmare in just everyday social dynamics. The boys who set upon a single schoolfellow, the grinning classmates watching the Jewish detainee.
They were precursors. They were enacting the thirst for domination inherent in the repressive society long before the adults were historically ripe. It reveals this deep-seated impulse for sadistic authority and group conformity.
Fascism becomes the inevitable explosion when the repressed desires and mutilations of the normal man are given an ideological vehicle.
Exactly.
And when anyone tries to point out this catastrophic intensification, they face the defense mechanism he lays out in aphorism 149. Don't exaggerate.
This is the eternal apologist's defense, isn't it? The argument that things have always been like this.
Right. It's used to discredit concrete, historically specific insight. It paints the critic as hysterical or lacking insight into the invariability of history.
But Adorno counters that this constancy of horror is itself deceptive. While horror may be perennial, The eternity of horror manifests in the fact that each of its new forms outdoes the old. This is the core concept of the intensification of antagonisms.
So to claim nothing has changed.
To treat the concentration camps as a technical mishap or just a continuation of historical violence is to ignore the qualitative leap into total administration and to allow the disaster to proceed unopposed. Critical insight must acknowledge the specific, increasing violence of the contemporary moment.
Which leads us to the intellectual's ethical response. If society is sick and normality is mutilation, how should thought operate? Aphorism 44, for post-Socratics, gives us the true morality of thought.
The primary ethical instruction is to abandon the wish to be right in discussion. That wish, Adorno argues, is inherently tied to the spirit of self-preservation.
Which we've already established is compromised by the system.
Exactly. If you seek to win or be right, you succumb to the logic of utility and hierarchy.
So instead, thought should seek what?
True freedom of thought lies in the ability to be, at every moment, both within things and beyond them. You have to engage with the material world directly, avoid abstraction, but at the same time, you have to maintain a critical distance that transcends the immediate compromised reality.
So the dialectician have to recognize that the ruling universal order is sick and potentially paranoid.
Yes. And if the ruling order is sick, then true critical thought will necessarily look sick by the order's standards.
That makes sense.
Healing cells may appear, by the standards of that order, as sick, eccentric, paranoia, indeed, mad. The role of the critical intellectual is to embrace that apparent sickness. The goal is not adjustment, it's truth.
And this explains Adorno's choice of style. In Aphorism 50, Gaps, he explicitly defends using fragments and aphorisms against the demand for, you know, a total system.
Yes, the demand for total logical transparency, often labeled intellectual honesty, where the writer must show every single step from premise to conclusion.
He calls it sabotage.
Sabotage of thought, because the value of a thought is measured by its distance from the continuity of the familiar. If your thought is too honest, too transparent, it just validates the established continuity.
So thought has to embrace guilt by foregoing full transparency to create space for the unfamiliar truth.
It must. It breaks the promise of the judgment form. But Adorno argues that this inadequacy, this fragment, it resembles that of life, which describes a wavering, deviating line.
It's a pointing by comparison with its premises.
And yet, which only in this actual course, always less than it should be, is able, under given conditions of existence, to represent an unregimented one.
The fragmented style is a necessary rebellion against the tyranny of the system.
That's it. It's the ultimate philosophical defense of the structure of minima moralia. The form itself is a political and ethical statement against the complete administration of life. The gap, the fragment.
Is reflection of the truth that life remains wavering and incomplete. Thank goodness.
Exactly. Part two leaves us with the mandate. Look to the eccentric, maintain critical distance, and use non-systematic form to avoid becoming a compliant specimen of the majority.
Okay, we're moving now to the final third of the book, written in 1946. This is where Adorno addresses the largest spheres of human life, love, wealth, and the culture industry.
And the melancholic tone really intensifies here as he explores the total contamination of these traditionally autonomous concepts.
He's exploring the wreckage of concepts that people traditionally rely on as a kind of retreat from the external world.
Love and memory.
Right. But Adorno shows that these intimate spheres are just as permeated by the logic of the market.
We can start with memory and love and aphorisms 106 and 107. Aphorism 106, all the little flowers, it critiques memory as a possession.
The idea that memory is a possession that no one can take from us.
He dismisses that as impotently sentimental consolation. By retreating into the archive of your own past, the subject turns their inner life into furniture.
That's a great image.
But the core insight is that later, present despair can, in its very substance, revoke the most blissful memory.
So the past is not safe from the present. The misery of today poisons the joy of yesterday.
Precisely. Despair draws the past into its vortex. You can't just keep the past pure. If you die in despair, Adorno argues, you've lived your whole life in vain because the past is recontextualized by that ultimate failure.
So the past has to be brought to disaster.
So that it can emerge as something different. It's an astonishing refusal of simple nostalgia.
And this dissolution of memory is mirrored in the dissolution of erotic relations in Aphorism 107. Ne cherchez plus mon cœur, seek no more my heart.
Adorno sees the objective dissolution of society mirrored perfectly in the weakening of the erotic urge. Love is chilled by the value that the ego places on itself.
The economic logic of self-preservation.
Ruthlessness, specialization. It has fully permeated desire.
If love traditionally meant self-abandonment, modern atomized society makes that impossible.
It becomes a terrible kind of competitive transaction. If loving more means giving without accounting for it,
then loving more puts himself in the wrong.
Exactly. The lover who displays too much desire is seen as weak, vulnerable, economically compromised. The whole species, Adorno suggests, is imitating the frigid aloofness, the self-preserving nature of the loved one.
Which is now an institution of mass culture.
Yes. The system only permits desire mediated by competition.
And Aphorism 59, since I set eyes on him, delivers a searing critique of the feminine ideal within this framework of domination.
Adorno asserts that the feminine character and the ideal modeled on it, they aren't essential truths. They are negative imprints of domination.
So the feminine character is what's left over after masculine patriarchal domination has done its work.
Right. He references the psychoanalytic view that women experience their physical constitution as a consequence of castration or deficiency.
And how does he relate that back to self-awareness?
He says, the woman who truly feels herself a wound, who recognizes her position as a result of domination, knows more about herself than the one who imagines herself a flower because that suits her husband.
The idealization of femininity as a flower
is fundamentally a humiliation. It's perfidious advice to maintain the role dictated by the dominator. Liberation requires abolishing its self-fabrication. Femininity itself is the effect of the whip.
This total penetration of market logic into intimacy and gender, it brings us to Aphorism 119, model of virtue, wealth, and morality, the identity of goodness and goods.
Adorno argues this connection has existed since the beginning. The moral man is one who rules himself as effectively as he rules his property.
And this provides the tenacious illusion that wealth and goodness are linked,
which prevents any confrontation with the unjust material order itself.
But how does the rich man become just? In society's eyes,
he does so systematically. He represents the realization of the general principle of self-preservation and control, and he's supported by the supreme might of the law by which society reproduces itself.
It connects to Max Weber's idea of intramundane asceticism.
Yes, the idea that material success is taken as a sign of moral election. It vouches for the possibility of reuniting the inward and outward life through self-discipline and control.
So the rich man's goodness is really just the necessary moral framework required to justify immense unequal property.
His self-control is simply the absence of material conflict. It's a structural necessity.
Because he doesn't have to struggle for survival, he can appear measured, rational, and just.
Which prevents society from questioning the material conditions of injustice because wealth has already been rendered morally good.
This total ideological absorption culminates in Adorno's most famous critique, the culture industry. He details this in Aphorisms 129 and 131. Aphorism 129, service to the customer, critiques the industry's sham message.
The culture industry, which manufactures mass media, film, radio, magazines, it rigidly divides its products into escape and message.
Escape is the distraction. The pure entertainment.
And message is the moral instruction. Be noble, be helpful, be kind, be adjustable.
The untruth is that the idealized message is entirely detached from the work's internal logic, which is pure profit.
It's disposable morality, pasted on for market appeal. It becomes a piece of matter to be provided from stock, therefore at once palpable and null.
The message itself becomes a form of escape.
Yes. Because it gives the consumer the false satisfaction of having engaged with virtue without having to change their material reality.
He who sets about cleaning up the house he lives in energetically enough, Adorno writes, forgets the foundation it is built on.
The message makes you a better specimen, not a critical thinker.
And Aphorism 131, Wolf's grandmother, dismisses the common defense of film as a form of genuine folk art.
Apologists claim that film's use of stereotypes and its immediate narrative style were just extensions of traditional folk art or fairy tales reflecting genuine needs.
Adorno calls this a total delusion.
Folk art arose from immediate human relationships in agrarian society. Late industrial society has liquidated the folk. It reduces individual subjects to moments before uniting them, impotent and discrete in the collective.
So the film's immediacy is synthetic. It's mediation without residue.
It is socialization achieved so perfectly that men enjoy their own dehumanization as something human. They enjoy the feeling of warmth and belonging that comes from total conformity.
The culture industry transforms subjects so indistinguishably into social functions that conflict isn't even perceived anymore.
It is regression organized by total enlightenment. It forces the audience to swallow the justice of the existing world order.
This totalizing vision brings us to a moment of, I guess, conceptual resistance in Aphorism 150, Novissimum Organum, the newest organon, which challenges the very concept of progress.
Adorno argues that modern thought and production have embraced development in only one direction: quantitative increase, technical speed, profit. It's profoundly hostile to qualitative difference.
Progress, as we currently define it, is just a perpetual treadmill of more.
But he offers a radical alternative vision of emancipation, moving beyond this compulsive activity.
What's the vision?
If true emancipated society means emancipation from this totality, then possibilities hostile to the single direction of progress might be left unused.
Like what?
He suggests a hypothetical future where mankind, finally free of want, might grow tired of development and instead seek the peace of simply lying on the water and looking peacefully at the sky.
A cessation of activity as the highest form of achievement.
It's the ultimate inversion of capitalist morality. It would truly keep the promise of dialectical logic by culminating in pure being rather than frantic, never-ending development.
Enjoyment is currently inseparable from operating, planning, having one's way, subjugating.
Yes. Peace, eternal peace, is the only concept that truly approaches fulfilled utopia, a freedom from the necessity of production and progress.
Which sets the stage for the famous conclusion, Aphorism 153 finale, the standpoint of redemption. If the world is this totally damaged, how can philosophy maintain its integrity?
This is the final ethical instruction for the intellect. The only philosophy responsibly practiced in the face of total despair is the attempt to contemplate all things as they would present themselves from the standpoint of redemption.
What does that mean for someone reading this today? It sounds almost theological.
Adorno immediately clarifies that the reality or unreality of redemption hardly matters. This is an epistemological necessity, not a theological commitment.
Okay, so what does it mean practically?
It means viewing the broken world not through the lens of what is possible within the existing compromise constraints, the logic of the market, the culture industry, but through the possibility of a world free from those constraints.
So you use the concept of perfect wholeness as a necessary critical lens to expose how broken the current reality is.
Exactly. Thought must comprehend its own impossibility, its inevitable failure to fully capture truth while remaining shackled by the damaged world it reflects. For the sake of the possible.
It's the last defense of hope.
Preserved through negation and uncompromising critique.
So to synthesize Adorno's overall project in Minima Moralia, I mean, it's a magnificent work of negative anthropology. It demonstrates with almost painful clarity how the logic of quantification, specialization, and self-preservation.
The central tenets of late capitalism.
Right. How they penetrate every intimate corner of life.
It forces us to confront the fact that the individual has become a pure reflection of the power structure that oppresses them. Love, tact, memory, thought itself. They're all deformed by the commodity form.
The sickness isn't an external influence.
The sickness is normality. The individual is forced to be dead inside in order to function in a world where self-preservation annuls all life and subjectivity.
And the power of the book lies in its unflinching capacity to identify this deformation, even in the smallest gestures, the aggressive sound of a slamming car door, the forced camaraderie, the satisfaction of labeling your own neurosis.
It asks you to feel the pain of the damaged world.
Which brings us back to Aphorism 128 concerning the capacity for suffering and joy.
Adorno observed that the capacity for fear and the capacity for happiness are fundamentally the same. They both rely on the unrestricted openness to experience amounting to self-abandonment.
The world is deeply ailing.
And anyone who cautiously adapts to it, anyone who aims for adjustment or well-being as defined by the system,
by this very act, shares in its madness.
The lesson being that true self-preservation isn't conformity but resistance. The eccentric alone would stand their ground.
The true measure of happiness, then, is not the manufactured joy sold by the culture industry, but its inverse.
The possibility of happiness is only open if that happiness is measured by the immeasurable grief at what is. If you stop grieving the damaged world, if you accept its brutality and its forced efficiency as normal,
you lose the ability to conceive of redemption.
And therefore, you lose the capacity for genuine happiness.
Okay, let's unpack this. So what does this all mean? It means Adorno asks us to treat every smooth moment of acceptance, every moment of easy adjustment, with suspicion. If you find yourself enjoying the standardized world too easily,
you might be the specimen of the majority.
The only integrity left is the integrity of the fragment. The refusal to belong. Keep diving.